Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Senator Ed Markey just met with the Pope about the threat of climate change. He'll tell us what Francis said and whether it will change minds in D.C. Then Assistant Secretary for Health Howard Koh and Wheelock President Jackie Jenkins Scott on public health crises facing America, from guns to childhood obesity. Then Emily Rooney on what to do with juvenile killers and how you recover from public embarrassment out there for all the world to see.
Callie Crossley on the resignation of Veterans Chief General Eric Shinseki and the passing of Maya Angelou. Also, Attorney General Martha Coakley, caught parking in a tow zone. We'll ask you, what sneaky bad things would you do if you knew you'd never get caught? And then our Friday news quiz with two local women hoping to hit the big time by convincing the rest of us to eat bugs. Good. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hi there, Marjorie. Jim. What did you say?
I said hello, Jim.
Well, I said hello, Marjorie.
Hello.
How are you?
Hello, hello.
So Pope Francis has electrified the world, from his positions on poverty to homosexuality to his willingness to baptize aliens, he said, should outer space present him with such an opportunity. He's also a defender of Mother Earth, calling on his fellow Christians to become, quote, custodians of creation, and issuing a dire warning about the potentially catastrophic effects of global warming. As Senator Ed Markey told the Boston Globe, the Pope has the potential to elevate this issue to a whole new level of importance. Senator Markey met with Pope Francis earlier this week in Rome as the only American in a delegation that supports environmental protection. He knows better than anyone that in the U.S., the Northeast is bearing the brunt of climate change. Listen to this. Over the past century, temperatures in northeastern states have risen by 2 degrees Fahrenheit. And if the trend continues, warming could spike as much as 10 degrees here by the 2080s. Senator Markey joins us on the line, fresh from meeting with Pope Francis. Senator, it's good to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Hello, Senator Markey. You told John Allen from the Boston Globe, and if people don't know this, you are a Boston College and Boston College Law School graduate, both Jesuit schools. I don't know. Are you a triple eagle, Senator Markey?
No, Malden Catholic and the Immaculate Conception Grammar School.
So okay.
To complete the 20 years in a row.
Okay. Well, okay. We get the Jesuit education there going at least part of the way. You had the chance to meet the first Jesuit Pope. And you called it one of the most important moments you'll ever have as a senator, as a Catholic, and a human being. Why?
Well, you know, if you're born and raised in the kind of environment that I was, which was a plan by my mother and father to put me into the Immaculate Conception Grammar School and then to go through the entire system, and to actually ultimately have the Jesuits teach about Pierre de Chardin, the incredible Jesuit philosopher, Payard, who was somebody that talked about the interconnectivity of mankind, how we're all related, and then to have a Jesuit Pope, the first Jesuit Pope after this greatest of all Jesuit philosophers, Pierre de Chardin of the 20th century, talked to us and instruct us all that we had a responsibility for not just ourselves, but for everyone around us and for the entire planet. It was one of those moments when you're shaking the hand of the Pope and you're getting a chance to talk to him that I wish my mother could know that it happened. And I think that everyone who is a Catholic would feel the same way.
I have to say, as a non-Catholic, I probably feel pretty close to the same way, Senator. Before we get to the content of your meeting and your discussion and what the takeaway is, you've met with presidents, obviously. You meet with world leaders. How intimidating is it, particularly after this beautiful description you gave us of a minute ago, how intimidating is it to be in the personal presence of a Pope?
Again, for me, to have this opportunity to talk about climate change with him, but also with his Secretary of State, who runs the Vatican, and with others, was about as great an honor as you can have as a Catholic, as a member of the species, because in many ways he has now become the moral authority for the planet. And the issues on which he is speaking, including climate change, are those which infuse all of our actions with this sense of moral purpose. And so for me, although I've met presidents and I've met all these great sports heroes, at the bottom line, let's be honest, especially those of us who are Christians, or actually, we were taught from an early age about the second hometown that we had. In addition to the one we grew up in, there was Bethlehem, there was Jerusalem, there was Nazareth, there was the Sea of Galilee. And every day that we were talked to about this man, Jesus, and his philosophy, and how we should try to live it. And here, the Pope is the extension of that in our own time. And for me, there could be no more powerful moment.
So, Ed Markey, tell us about the meeting. We know you had a minute with him. Tell us what you said. Tell us what the Pope had to say to the delegation you were part of.
Well, there were six of us, one from the Philippines, from Mexico, from Great Britain, from South Africa, and from Italy. And we each got to speak to him about this issue, because he is right now in the process of drafting an encyclical on climate change. He has said as recently as last week that if we destroy creation, creation will destroy us. And I was trying to communicate to him how important his message will be, that we, representative of the legislators of the world who have to pass the laws that will reduce the likelihood of the most catastrophic consequences of climate change, we need this infusion of moral authority as well to help to catalyze us in each one of our countries. And we here in the United States, you know, we can't preach temperance from a bar stool. We can't be telling others to do it if we ourselves are not reducing our own carbon pollution. And so I basically said to him that the planet is running a fever. There are no emergency rooms for planets. We have to engage in preventative care, and that his voice will give the moral power to legislators around the world by having ordinary Catholics, Christians, but everyone know that something must be done.
We're talking to Senator Ed Markey from Massachusetts. Just had a chance to meet with the Pope in Rome about climate change. Do you think, Senator, you know, obviously there are climate change deniers. You have a suggestion for them. We'll get to that in a second. But do you think that because of the Pope's popularity and the increased moral authority of his papacy, because of his personality, this is going to make a difference for those people that are in denial?
I don't know about the deniers, but I know about those who are being influenced by the deniers. When the Pope speaks, I think it will give a lot of people, not just here in the United States, but around the world, a reason to step back and evaluate whether or not that which the oil companies, the coal companies, the Koch brothers of our country, but of all countries, are saying about this subject is in fact accurate. And I think that's going to be a very important moment, because it will help us to ensure that the message that the science is accurate, and that in a lot of ways that the science is an answer to our prayers, that we will be able to move people politically on this issue. The congresswoman from the Philippines, you know, told the Pope how important it was for him to speak, because their country had been devastated, obviously, last year with maybe the worst typhoon in world history, and the damage was incalculable. The Mexican congressman said the same thing. So in each instance, I think they were saying that not just Catholics, but Christians and everyone will be responding if the Pope steps in and really makes this a moral and political challenge for the planet.
Senator Markey, a few years ago, you had a great suggestion I thought it was a great suggestion anyway, for climate change deniers. What was that suggestion?
Well, that as these huge, huge blocks of ice break off the Antarctic, that we just allow them to become countries, and we can call it the country of denial, and there'll be enough room on these huge ice blocks for every denier to be able to live. And that's really what we've been learning in the last, you know, a few months, that the Antarctic is now starting to come apart. And it's almost like, if you want to think about why it's important, that if you have a glass of water and it's already filled up to the top, and you put an ice cube on top, well, the water spills over. And so that's really what the ice of Antarctic or Greenland is. If that ice goes off the land and into the ocean, well, the rest of the ocean is going to start to go up higher and higher. And that's really the danger for not just New Bedford and Fall River and downtown Boston, but for poor countries all around the world that will be negatively impacted. And these deniers continue to pretend that what's happening in Antarctic, what's happening in the Arctic, is unrelated ultimately to the lives of ordinary people.
Senator Ed Markey, let's go back to Congress if we can for a second. You said you believe, I'm paraphrasing what you said a minute ago, you think it can influence, not deniers, but those who are not deniers but have some doubts. My concern about this is, yes, the Pope's encyclical has a impact on real people. Americans rally around it, potentially, with leadership from a handful of politicians who care about it as much as the Pope does. But, you know, we saw a situation where, 90% of Americans supported background checks and Congress did nothing about it. Do you really, is there even one of your colleagues who you think will hear what the Pope has to say, even if he or she is praising the Pope 24/7, who all of a sudden is going to have an epiphany and worry, focus more on science and moral authority than they do on catering to the polluters? I mean, that's my fear, is that as wonderful as this is, that he's going to enter the fray, Pope Francis, that is, that most of your colleagues are worried about one thing, which is, will they get reelected?
I think ultimately there are people who decide elections, and they tend not to be ideological. They tend to be people who are trying to listen to both sides. And they can swing one way or the other. And if there is a massive amount of propaganda that is going out from one side that is actually distorting the reality, I think at the end of the day, if the Pope speaks, if activists at the grassroots across our country and across the world continue to work hard, then we will continue to make real progress. When I started to make the amendment on the House floor to increase fuel economy standards in 2001, we were at 25 miles per gallon, and I lost in 2001, I lost in 2003, I lost in 2005, but in 2007, I won. And today, the auto manufacturers now brag that they have 41 highway, 39 city, and they're heading towards 54 miles per gallon by the year 2025. But it wasn't overnight. It was a fight each year, year after year, before my provision ultimately became the law. And I think the same thing is going to be true here, that obviously it's no one moment, but I think his additional statements and moral power help to tilt the issue towards the truth, towards what people will see is something that has to happen. And I think that ultimately Congress is a stimulus response institution, and there's nothing more stimulating than thousands of parish priests, bishops, all reiterating a position like this as people are walking out on Sunday morning trying to decide which is the right side of the issue. And at the end of the day, politicians will respond, and we will win on this issue. It's only a question of whether or not we do it in enough time to actually save the planet from the worst, most catastrophic consequences.
Senator, before you go away, since we have you, just minutes ago we heard that General Shinseki, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, has stepped down. The president has accepted his resignation. What's your quick reaction to that, Senator Markey?
Well, you know, he was a great soldier and a good man. In March of 2014, not one soldier died in Iraq. Not one soldier died in Afghanistan, but 700 veterans committed suicide in March 2014. And I think everyone now realizes that the VA and all of us have to do a much better job. These people served us. We have to serve them. We have a much greater obligation than has been discharged up until now. And let's just hope that we can now put in place the kinds of policies, the kind of funding that is going to be necessary to deal with traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress. Could be upwards of 50% of all the people who have come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. It's just time for all of us in America to have this conversation. And this just might turn out to be the silver lining of this entire controversy.
Senator Markey, we really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Senator Ed Markey. He's just returned from Rome, where he, along with other legislators, met with Pope Francis to discuss climate change. Senator Markey, again, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Up next, we talk public health with Dr. Howard Koh, the Assistant Secretary for Health in the United States Department of Health and Human Services, and Jackie Jenkins-Scott, President of Wheelock College. Stay tuned for that on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Weeknights on WGBH2 Greater Boston takes you beyond the day's headlines and presents a deeper perspective on stories that matter. For greater perspective, watch Greater Boston, weeknights at 7 on WGBH2.
Research shows that retaining good teachers has to do with much more than just money. I'm Kara Miller. That's this week on Innovation Hub, Saturday morning at 10 here on WGBH Radio.
Support for WGBH comes from you and North Shore Music Theater's production of Anything Goes, the High Seas musical featuring Cole Porter's classic songs You're the Top, DeLovely, Friendship, and many more. Anything Goes, playing June 3rd through the 15th, nsmt.org. And New England Wildflower Society, committed to conserving and promoting the region's native plants to ensure healthy, biologically diverse landscapes. Information at newenglandwild.org/protect.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. This week, we've seen major public health issues making the headlines. One obviously involves mental health and gun control by way of the shootings in Santa Barbara. The other is the First Lady Michelle Obama's open plea to Congress that they not bag healthy school lunches. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about these and other public health concerns are Dr. Howard Koh. Dr. Koh is the Assistant Secretary for Health in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And Jackie Jenkins-Scott is President of Wheelock College, which is a private institution local, obviously, that focuses on the welfare of children and families. Welcome to both of you. Good to see you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in. So may we start with two things that Jim and I are obsessed with, and then we can move on to the things you may be obsessed with or worried about in terms of health issues, kids issues, and so forth. Jim just mentioned Michelle Obama. She's been on this crusade since she became the First Lady to help with childhood obesity. One of the big things she's done helped have more healthy lunches in schools. Now we learn that certain members of Congress want to backtrack on that. And in Boston, we possibly are facing the loss of salad bars in at least six schools to give kids more healthy choices. So how big a deal is this, Dr. Koh? Let's start with you.
Well, we're very proud of the First Lady and her leadership in the Let's Move initiative. In fact,
My department's been very involved in coordinating these issues on her behalf and throughout government and throughout the country. We have mayors and county officials very, very involved. We have school systems involved, as you just mentioned, and we have big emphasis on better nutrition and physical activity. Now, this is just one part of the history that you're recounting today, but I think when you look at the long lens, we have now healthier lunches and breakfasts supplied in some 1,000 public schools, which is a huge step forward and a real culture change in how we address childhood obesity involving multiple parts of society. So there are issues today that we're wrestling with, but I think the progress forward has been really substantial.
Are you not worried there's going to be a backtrack now with this push from – it's mostly been Republicans, actually.
In the House, yeah.
Yeah, saying they don't want these money spent on these more healthy lunches.
I think we're moving forward because everyone realizes that obesity is one of the major public health challenges of our time, particularly for kids.
Yep.
And you got to do more than just encourage exercise and healthier foods in homes. You have to have schools involved. You have to have child care centers involved. And that's what the Let's Move initiative has really – spearheaded in a very exciting way.
Jackie Jenkins-Scott, I'm sure a lot of the people who come out of your institution realize how critical this issue is. I've said repeatedly, we were discussing yesterday, as a fairly round little boy myself, but there's so much fallout from being a kid who's overweight, from the ridicule, sure. potential Absolutely. Bullying, to the educational impacts. Do average people get the fact that this is not just an issue of being fit or not fit, but has so much impact on the rest of your life?
Absolutely. And I'm not sure about average people, but I can tell you what we are working hard with our students, both our faculty and our students, who are placed in some 300 settings in the Boston area. And these issues are critically important. About 6 years ago, Wheelock College had a great opportunity to work with then Mayor Menino and Superintendent Carol Johnson to really look at physical activity in the Boston public schools. And we actually issued a report because there were many schools where there was literally no physical activity.
Do you know what the state law is? The state law mandates physical activity. You're the former health guy in Massachusetts, right. Dr. Koh, you know this, yeah. but doesn't require any minimal level.
Right.
So many schools have nothing.
No, they have nothing. And we issued a report really looking at what was happening in the Boston public schools and have had the privilege of working with the superintendent, then Carol Johnson, and her staff to increase physical activity in Boston public schools. And we're working particularly with the Mattahunt Elementary School in Mattapan, which, as you all may know, is a very vulnerable area of the city of Boston. So these are very important issues that we hope our students leave committed to continuing to work on.
What are they doing at the school in Mattapan? Having more recess?
Actually,
that's
more,
a big deal.
More recess is important, more exercise time. We have working with the school in partnership to run in the community center, the after-school center, and working with the Mattapan Community Health Center. And physical exercise is important. After-school exercise is important. So we've been very privileged to elevate this issue and this topic.
You know, Dr. Koh, you look like an incredibly calm guy, and I remember you from your life here. You were a calm guy, but when you're in your office alone, aren't you ready to have your head pop off when you hear something as basic as child nutrition, having healthy nutritional regulations? They're at risk of disappearing and having kids stuff Doritos in their mouth. How do you deal with the stress and anxiety when you know something is so important and so right and has potential to be taken away? Look at the smile on you. I don't get this. How do you deal with this, Dr. Koh?
Well, Jim, I appreciate your passion on this. And let me just say, as a physician, I'm doing these jobs and have had the honor of serving these physicians because I feel that good health is a gift. Needs to be protected every day, and that's what prevention and public health is all about. That's why President Jenkins Scott's college is so important, because we've got leaders who care about children and families. But none of this work is easy. You can't assume that because you've made progress today that you'll be able to sustain it tomorrow. So I think one of the biggest challenges and one of the biggest commitments for all of us is to make sure that we accelerate progress, never take any progress for granted, keep the long view, and try to make our kids and our families as healthy as possible over upcoming generations. And that's the way we have to do our work.
Well, speaking of keeping people and kids, and particularly young men, healthy in future generations, as you know, Dr. Koh, the White House picked to be the nation's Surgeon General top doctor, and you're in charge of that
Surgeon General's office.
It's been stalled since February, and the reason it's been stalled is because the National Rifle Association does not like the president's pick for Surgeon General because he has said that guns are a health matter in the United States of America, which seems to me, no matter how you feel about the Second Amendment and NRA issues and the bigger issues and the details, they are a health issue. And they're getting he's been stalled since February. They're going to be stalled right through the midterms.
Well, this is quite a time in Washington for any nomination in any leadership position, as you well know. I think with respect to violence in general, this is a public health issue, and especially with respect to mental health and its link with violence and gun violence. We're hearing a lot about this lately.
Yes.
So these are issues that the administration has tackled head on, the vice president and the president, and we need to address the mental health issues more directly. The president has put forward his proposals on gun control that have received a lot of attention. So we need our leaders in Washington to work through this and try to make future episodes less common. But we're suffering through a lot of tragedies right now. There's no doubt about that.
And one of the champions of this is the former mayor of New York City, who actually is a Medford kid, grew up in Medford. Michael Bloomberg was actually the commencement speaker yesterday at Harvard, and he spoke a little bit about the nominee and gun violence during yesterday's graduation.
This year, the Senate has delayed a vote on President Obama's nominee for Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, a Harvard physician, because he had the audacity to say that gun violence is a public health crisis that should be tackled. The gall of him.
What's your reaction to this? I mean, obviously, you're a Bostonian. You know this. We see this in our city. Marjorie and I, 2 weeks ago, 2 Sundays ago on Mother's Day, we're at the Mother's Day March for Peace. We're with the families of hundreds of people who've lost a son, a daughter, a husband, a wife, a sibling to gun violence.
Sure.
As Marjorie said, it doesn't get more basic than saying it's a public health issue. Let's at least focus on it, regardless of where you are.
One of the things that we were so honored to have Dr. Koh as our commencement speaker, and one of the points he made with our students was to find something beyond yourself to work on and to be passionate about. And the reality is we have to organize and we have to advocate. And the message to young people is that you have a role in this. You have a role in demanding what's best for society and working towards that. And that's, I think, a very important message. None of us can make the changes that need to be made alone.
Are either of you hopeful on this front? I have to say, we talk about guns a lot here for a variety of reasons, mostly off the news, but John King from CNN joins us every Tuesday, and we talk about what Congress is doing. I have to say, I look for signs of hope, but when you see a couple of dozen little kids, 6 and 7-year-olds, gunned down in Connecticut, when you see a guy in his YouTube video in California going out hunting for blondes and sororities, and virtually nothing happens, you say to yourself, you can be as optimistic as you want, nothing's going to happen on this front. Do you feel differently, Jackie Jenkins-Scott?
Well, I think that, but you also have to look at the work that is being done. And I think there are people who will not let this issue die, and there will continue. Our graduates, I am hoping, are going to be out there advocating, pushing for change, pushing for legislation. That's the beauty of commencement. You know, that is what happens when thousands of young people who have graduated in this last few weeks and they get a message from a Howard Koh that says, find that issue, find your passion, and work towards the change that needs to happen. And it is happening, not as fast as you and I would like, but it's out there. And there is energy and there is movement. And I think you have to remain hopeful.
That's a glass-half-full woman if I ever saw
Howard
one.
Howard Koh also said in that great commencement address, we should all have more gratitude in our lives, and maybe you and I, Jim, don't
have enough
gratitude.
Well, thanks for reading it. Thank you.
But I wanted to ask you one thing, because you are a physician, obviously, Howard Koh. We have a medical ethicist that we speak with from time to time, Art Kaplan. He's a great guy, talking about the possible role of physicians with their patients, pediatricians or regular doctors, asking about their patients' interaction with guns in their home, that they could kind of take a proactive role to talk about, are there guns in their home? Do they know how to store them safely? That sort of thing. Could you see the American Medical Association maybe taking a leading role, since it may not be coming from the politicians anytime soon?
Well, one of our big public health messages is that we have to talk about prevention from an early age, and kids have to start thinking about the attitude of gratitude and the gift of health from an early age. So when we have parents involved and families involved and they're teaching their kids how to be as safe and as healthy as possible, this is where parents can certainly play a role in that area and so many others, whether it's protecting a kid's health from tobacco addiction or from substance abuse, being more open talking about emotional health issues, which deserve much more attention right now. So I think the role of a parent and a family really is critically important, and we want everybody to be involved in the prevention message for public health.
Why are we, the two issues we've discussed so far, and then we're going to get to whatever may be at the top of your list, childhood obesity and guns. The United States is the outlier on both these things. We're amongst the, for lack of a less crass expression, one of the fattest nations on earth. I think Mexico may have passed this last year. We, in terms of guns, the rest of the Western world looks at us as if we just don't get it, which many of us think. Why, doctor? I mean, you've been involved in the field for your life as a physician and as obviously someone in leadership on these issues. Why do we have such a cultural difference from the rest, virtually the rest of the Western world? What's that about?
Well, so much of public health depends on where you live and the culture of your society and what's prized in terms of individual rights versus the role of government and these other issues that can lead to great debate. A lot of these trends also, Jim, depend on timing and a tipping point. I know you just had Senator Markey on talking about climate change.
Yeah.
And I'm very involved in those issues right now. And it's fascinating to see how that issue has now risen to the top of the public health agenda in a relatively short period of time. So a lot of this, I think, will depend on timing, whether you have the right public leaders coming forward to make statements, a coalescence of forces. And again, taking that long view is critically important in public health. And I think, as Jackie mentioned, we have a lot of things to celebrate, and we can always look at the glasses half full in so many areas.
So we have two glass half full people and two glass half empty people.
Right.
So there's good balance.
Right.
I'm sorry, Jackie Jenkins Scott, I interrupted you. What were you about to say?
No, I was just, to Dr. Koh's point, I think about smoking and how far
we've come as a nation
around smoking. Now, you know, we've had some going forward and backwards, but look where we are as a nation with smoking.
And by the way, Tom Menino being one of the early leaders on that in the city of Boston.
Yeah.
I mean, we're in the forefront. There's no question. Yeah. So you're both long view kind of people.
Absolutely.
So childhood obesity and guns are something we talk about a lot on the show. Starting with you, Dr. Koh, what are one or two of the public health things that you think should be at the top of the average person's agenda that maybe aren't?
Well, I'm so glad President Jenkins Scott mentioned tobacco, because we've made, on one hand, tremendous progress in that arena. We just celebrated in January the 50th anniversary of the landmark Surgeon General's report on tobacco, and we could celebrate that some 8 million deaths were prevented because of tobacco control in the last 50 years, with leaders like the mayor of Boston, past and current. But the challenge is we have some 5.6 million kids alive right now who will die prematurely from tobacco dependence. So tobacco is still the number one preventable cause of death in the country and indeed the world. There's no other condition that's projected to kill a billion people around the world this century. And unfortunately, that issue has fallen off the radar screen for far too many. So we need to keep talking about the importance of kids staying tobacco-free and themes like that for public health in the future.
We've talked a bit recently about the e-cigarette thing, and the last time we talked about it was about a month ago, and we said the jury was still out on whether or not it was beneficial or whether there's a negative impact. There was at least one study the other day that says it is, but they are potentially helpful in weaning people away from or getting them not to smoke. Do you buy into that? Is that legit?
Well, e-cigarettes are a double-edged sword right now. First of all, we don't know enough about them scientifically to either support them or to restrict them. But we first know that we have to take the very first step, which is to have the FDA regulate them. And I don't know if you follow this, Jim, but just a month ago, the FDA came out with proposed rules to regulate e-cigarettes, pipe, and roll-your-own tobacco in a process, what we call deeming. So those proposed regulations are out, and the public's welcome to comment on those. We're very concerned that e-cigarettes are right now not regulated, that kids are starting to use them, that their use is increasing. This is an addictive product for kids who are facing so many other threats. And this is, again, another area where prevention is very, very important while we wait for the science to become mature.
We're talking with Dr. Howard Koh, the Assistant Secretary for Health in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and President Jackie Jenkins Scott, president of Wheelock College. I said president twice. Was there something else you wanted to mention? Because Jim asked you if you had a couple of things.
No, I'm not done with cigarettes first. I have a much more important question.
Are you moving on to cigarettes?
No,
okay.
I want to stay with cigarettes
okay,
for a second.
Go ahead.
Marjorie is of the opinion, Dr. Koh, totally uninformed, that Barack Obama, when he says he quits smoking, is not telling the truth. And she doesn't want him to be telling the truth. Her attitude is,
when
he's out of office, he should stop. When he's got all this stress,
if it helps him deal with the problems of the entire world, I say, you know, if you're going to have a couple of Marlboros at the end of the day, then you can quit.
So do you have any inside dope on what Barack Obama's actually doing or not doing?
We're all ears here.
The president's physician has declared him tobacco-free.
Has he?
Yeah,
I didn't read that.
Oh, absolutely, on several occasions.
I heard he wraps his hair in a towel and then sneaks out on the back porch, has a cigarette.
And just as importantly, his wife has declared him tobacco-free.
Well, that's probably more
okay.
important.
Okay. So is it, President Jenkins-Scott, is there anything particular that you're focusing on right now that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, I think the issues of violence, particularly violence around women. I think the issues, you know, the unspoken issues that we try not to deal with around diversity and race issues, and the stresses of particularly young people in urban settings are all important public health issues that not enough time today to talk about, but have to be continued to be addressed.
Well, you know, along those lines, then, as long as you brought it up, one of the things that we've talked about many times, and no one is begrudging the attention that went to the victims of the Boston Marathon. That was a terrorist attack, and it captured the city and the nation. But, I mean, I'm sure you've heard this complaint before. You talked to some wonderful people, the Odoms, Ron and Kim Odom, who lost their son at 13, and they've expressed, not begrudging the marathon thing, but saying, gee, we are kind of living with terrorism on a daily basis.
Absolutely.
And we don't get the outpouring. And I don't know if it's because some of them are poor kids or many of them are black kids, or we don't get the kind of attention on inner city violence here or anywhere in the country.
Yeah. You know, we have on our campus a wonderful group of students who do spoken word. And all of our students have a field experience right from the very beginning, which is one of the things that we think makes Wheelock very special. And one of our students is in Chelsea, and she does poetry, spoken word poetry. And she wrote a poem about her student's reaction to the terrible marathon violence. And essentially, you know, the core was what you said. These students said, you know, we deal with this every day. And for us, April 15th was a day of no violence. And it was a very profound and moving to hear her talk about her experience as a young white woman from Wheelock College going to Chelsea every day. And her work with young people around violence prevention and the meaning of how we all have our own understandings of what's happening around us in our society. It was pretty remarkable poetry. I'd like to send that to you.
Yes,
I'd love to
see please do that to me.
You know, we're talking to Jackie Jenkins Scott, who's the president of Wheelock College, and Howard Koh, who you may remember from his Massachusetts past. He's now the Assistant Secretary for Health in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Another thing we talk about all the time here is social workers.
And President Jenkins Scott is one.
Oh, I'm aware of that, and that's why I'm bringing this up. You know, in the context of the Jeremiah Oliver death, the horrible death of his little 5-year-old boy from Fitchburg, there was much focus on the Department of Children and Families. A couple of social workers were fired, and the problem is they become the social worker as opposed to the vast majority of men and women. Sure. Marjorie, I think, brilliantly has referred to them as first responders. They really are. They're underpaid. They're undervalued. How do we change that? Let me start with you, Jackie Jenkins Scott. How do we change the perception of the social worker in this society who has, I mean, it's sort of like a first grade teacher in my mind. Mm. It can't get any worse in terms of the responsibility you have, the lack of respect you get, all these sort of things. How does one change that public perception, the value those people
are held think in? The kind of conversation we're having today is very, very important, both for, you're absolutely right. In some ways, these are first responders, and the work they do is tremendous work, and it's tremendous pressure. And we don't give them enough appreciation, enough pay, enough respect for the contribution they make to our society. And
why shouldn't they be paid like a cop and a firefighter? And by the way, that's not to disparage cops and firefighters. Yeah, I mean, they go in and save lives
just like
cops and firefighters do, don't they? I mean, I don't mean to be naive about this.
You get no question about that. We were just talking earlier about, you know, what happens with the decisions that policymakers have to make about where resources go. And these are very challenging times. And we hope, you know, just as teacher pay is a very important topic, too, that as we as a society decide where we want to put our values and where we put our resources is one way of saying what our values are as a society.
So you're going to do something about this, Dr. Koh, or what?
I was about to say that we have a great opportunity through the Affordable Care Act, which, of course, has gotten so much attention with respect to expanding insurance coverage, particularly in a state like Massachusetts. But it's also promoting better models of caring for people. The traditional model has been one doctor taking care of one patient every 10 minutes, one person at a time. And now there's much more attention to team-based approaches and encouraging groups of providers, including social workers, to work together and show that outcomes can be improved, the quality can be increased, and that costs can be saved. So our so-called Innovation Center for Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is funding a lot of innovation studies, and we're encouraging social workers and community health workers and people who care about prevention to be involved in these new teams to show that we can make advances with respect to improving care and lowering costs.
Okay, before you go, both of you, Dr. Koh, you look at your resume. It's incredible. From beginning to end, the accomplishments you have. How does it feel at your stage of life to know that your son is more talked about in Boston than you are? I mean, who is your son again, for those who don't know?
So my son is Daniel Koh. He's the chief of staff to Mayor Marty Walsh, the new mayor of Boston. I'm very, very proud of Dan and my three kids, one of whom just got a medical degree yesterday.
Oh, congratulations.
Terrific. Congratulations.
How's he like? Talk about being in the middle of stress. We're talking about the stress that you must have in your job, even though you suggest you don't. How does he react to the stress of a new mayor and all the demands and that sort of thing? How's he doing?
He's loving it. And I think he got to see, as did my other son and my daughter, what public service was all about when I was commissioner. And I would talk a lot about how you need to have a mission in your life and stand for something bigger than yourself. These things that I talked about in the Wheelock commencement. And Dan really is feeling that public service is his calling. So this opportunity came out of nowhere, really. And he's only 29.
We know that.
I found that very depressing.
But I'm very proud of him and Stephen, my son, and Katie, my daughter. They're really great kids.
Dr. Koh, President Jenkins Scott, it's good to see you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being with us. Dr. Howard Koh is the Assistant Secretary for Health in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and Jackie Jenkins Scott is the president of the wonderful, where I used to hire a lot of my babysitters from, Wheelock College. Thank you both for joining us. Up next, it's time for Open Mic with Emily Rooney. Stay tuned for that and her famous list of observations and obsessions. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Today at WGBHnews.org, filmmaker Errol Morris joined Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan to poke at the bubble that is Donald Rumsfeld. If you missed it on BPR, catch it online at WGBHnews.org right now.
I'm Joe Bergantino, the executive director of the New England Center for Investigative Reporting.
I'm Jennifer McKim.
I'm Rupa Shenoy.
I'm Beth Daly, a reporter.
A reporter.
A reporter with the New England Center for Investigative Reporting.
Now a partner in the WGBH newsroom.
WGBH Radio exists thanks to you and the Lincoln Motor Company, featuring a panoramic retractable roof on the 2014 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to over 15 square feet of skylight. More information at Lincoln.com. And Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, dedicated to defeating cancer, one person at a time in the clinic, one gene at a time in the laboratory. This special combination of care and research strives to offer patients the best possible outcome. Dana-Farber.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3, as she is every Friday and will be for many Fridays to come. That'd be Emily Rooney. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
Yeah, well, hello, Emily. So for people that don't know, and I can't imagine they don't, but just in case they don't, you made a huge announcement yesterday, assuring us that you were going to stay with us every Friday for your list. But what's your announcement?
I am going to give up my hosting anchor chair on Greater Boston at the end of the year.
Now,
I've been doing it for 17 years.
Have you bought your new tennis racket yet?
You know, I still can't play tennis. That's, you know, I started reconsidering it when because of my injury. So.
Oh, that's right.
I've been biking, though, instead.
You know, you wrote a great piece, which people should go read. It's on WGBHnews.org. I saw it this morning. It's called Give Me a Break. It is Emily Rooney's own description of Emily Rooney's next stage. You talk about a lot of people, people who made you nervous, people who this, and you say early on, you say, people always ask me what my best and worst interview has been. I can easily answer the latter, but not the former.
Worst.
But I'm not going to say. Yeah. Okay, what was your worst interview?
Oh, my God.
Come on, tell us.
I can't
Why can't you?
Well, tell us what was wrong with it. You don't have to tell us who the person was, unless you want to give us the initials.
Well, I'll describe him. And he's a public radio figure.
Oh.
You know, big glasses, huge glasses, and red sneakers. Is that a clue?
It's a clue. One of our producers is going to come up with this in about 10 seconds. Go ahead.
Huge glasses.
What was wrong with the interview?
Okay.
Arrogant beyond belief, beyond my wildest imagination, because I thought, you know, he's sort of one of us, and I thought it would be – sometimes I get really nervous and intimidated by somebody, and they turn out to be the nicest, most easygoing guy, and then somebody like this comes along and was, oh.
This isn't the guy who's made lots of movies, is he?
Let's move on.
Okay. All right, we'll move on. We'll move on.
Well, let's be clear here. But you have made a long-term commitment to Boston Public Radio. Is that correct?
That's
yes
true.
Or no?
I am definitely going to be here every Friday. I'll be at the station Thursdays and Fridays for sure.
Fine.
All
okay.
day. And sometimes in between.
Ooh.
By the way, our staff figured who it is, but they told us not to mention it. By the way, if you tweet me, I will tweet you back my guess.
I didn't see it. Where is it?
Here it is right there. Is that who it is? Is that who it is? Right here. Okay, it's
yep.
good. Okay, yes, it is. Okay, here's the deal. If you call my 800 number or my 900 number, I will have it on again.
I don't already.
Can I exactly. just like to say one thing before we leave there? I've never met him.
Yeah.
I listened to him on the air. One of the most arrogant people on air in the history. And I know arrogance, believe me. Okay, let's move on. Emily, Marjorie started a conversation with us. I guess it was the Monday after Elliot Rodger did what he did out in Santa Barbara. And it was the time, obviously, that Jared Remy was pleading guilty to having killed Jennifer Martel. And we had a discussion about the rise of misogyny and all, and not just in those two instances, but those being symbolic. Obviously, what's going on in the military, what's going on in universities, that sort of thing. You seem to be an outlier on this issue.
I think I am.
Why?
Because I read Elliot Rodger's manifesto, and this is not really misogyny. This guy had a classic Napoleon complex. He was very small. He was the smallest kid in his class in grade school. He was the smallest kid now. He was very short. And even though he was good looking, he thought his size was what interfered with women liking him. He was a good looking kid. I think he had a whole lot of other issues too. This manifesto is quite well written if you have the time. It's very tedious and it's repetitive, but he remembers every birthday in his life. He remembers every time he moved. His parents divorced when he was quite young. It's heartbreaking to read those chapters of his manifesto. It changed his life. And he talks about understanding the concept of a girlfriend for the first time when his father had a girlfriend. I couldn't imagine how he got a girlfriend so easily. And then I admired him for being able to get a girlfriend. Of course, not realizing he probably had the girlfriend all along. But you know, it was really that, I think. And then he had a terrible relationship with the stepmother. She threw him out of the house. I mean, it wasn't just women, you know. He had a lot of issues.
But I don't think anybody was arguing it's just women. But are you suggesting that his apparent hatred of women, for lack of a better word, I mean, that was a pretty central part of the mix. You're just saying there's more to it.
Yeah, he was going to kill his little brother, too. And he killed his roommates. Yeah. And they were men. So he had a neurosis, a psychotic, you know, something that went far beyond misogyny. And then that columnist for the Washington Post, Apatow, is that her name? She was saying it's movies like Seth Rogen's Neighbors, where the nerdy guy gets the beautiful girl that give people these kinds of complexes. And it's like, wait a second, you know, we're taking this thing and maybe overanalyzing something that may be simpler than that, which is that this guy really had a serious mental disorder.
Yeah, he did have a serious mental disorder. But I think the other idea that there is, I get a sense of it from my own kids, this growing kind of sense of hostility toward women.
For what reason?
I think it's a lot of things. I think it's a lot to do with the internet. I think, sadly, a lot of it has to do with the addiction of too many young men to pornography on the internet and their sort of sick associations between that and real women, which are, I think, very hurtful.
It's possible. I mean, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know anything about that world. Everybody likes a little porn. I've actually never tried
that,
it.
Please.
I have had on Greater Boston. I say that, but I've never clicked on it on the internet. I mean, so I don't know what that's all about.
Yeah.
But let me say, I didn't read the whole manifesto at all. I read excerpts, like I guess most people did. What I have read is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tweets with the hashtag #YesAllWomen. I'm sure you've read this too. Yeah. Where essentially average women around the country, young and old, are talking about how it's not just those women. It's in my life. I can't, you know, I have to lie and give a phony phone number to be safe to somebody who asked me for a date. I can't go into a party without having my behind grabbed by virtually every man. I mean, these stories
really?
Of mundane life. Yeah. The notion, I don't know if it's on the rise or not, but the expanse of poor treatment of women is unbelievable.
I think a lot of it is that young women today grow up, and good for them, with the sense that they're equal to men, and they're going to go out and have their careers, and they have a sense of, you know, I'm
and then
just
they discover
as good as
they're
the,
not.
Exactly.
Well, that is,
and,
I think that
I think
is the
in
cause.
Our day, you didn't grow up thinking you were equal to men, and if somebody got
no,
harassed.
Actually, I think our generation did.
Oh, boy. Well, mine didn't.
I'm older than you. I mean, I think we were the first one who kind of did feel that way.
Maybe you did growing up. I think maybe it depended on where you grew up, too.
See, but I think that's when you know the whole line about angry white men, particularly about the rise of people of color and they actually can get jobs that are used to be only for white. I think that's the heart of the problem. Maybe porn is a piece of it, as you say, on the internet. A part of it is men are just finally coming to the realization, oh, my God, all the jobs that were ours, all the pay that was ours, all the whatever that was ours. Women are getting it now, and I think there's a significant part of the population that can't handle that.
Or thinks that women should be subservient and be there.
Without a doubt.
There was a great piece written about Harvard Business School a while back talking about the women there, who obviously are some of the best and brightest because they got into Harvard Business School, and how a lot of the men at Harvard Business School really don't want to go out with them because they're too smart, they're too threatening, they're too whatever.
Well, don't we all have friends who, you know, dumped their first wife, went for somebody a lot younger, a lot stupider, you know, because it was just easier. It's more fun to have somebody.
I'm not that friendly with Donald Sterling. Just wait, no, I'm really not. You know, Emily, one of the stories that I'm, you know, every time I mention obsession, I look at you because you get obsessed with things like I get obsessed with things, and I love that about you. This whole, everybody knows there's a Supreme Court case, a conservative Supreme Court, a couple of years ago, followed by a liberal Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts following suit, basically saying that mandatory life sentences for juvenile killers, murderers, or people convicted of crime are a violation of the Constitution. They're cruel and unusual. And by the way, most local television stations are misreporting this, saying you can't give a juvenile life without parole. You can.
Yes.
It can't be mandatory.
Right.
The judge has to have discretion. Well, as part of this, I've read 63 in some places, 65 in others. There are 63 or 65 people in Massachusetts who were sentenced to life without parole for murder-related crimes that are now eligible if they've served at least 15 years for prison, parole hearings, the first two of which happened yesterday. The one is worth talking about for a second is Joseph Donovan. The incredible part, he punched this guy who later was stabbed and killed, an MIT student, when he was 17. He didn't do the killing. The guy who did the actual killing was out of jail after 10 years. The family, in this case, of the dead young man supports the release of this guy, and the DA is sort of in the middle of this thing. My long-winded question, what's your reaction to the whole thing?
This is a perfect test case. I mean, my guess is they will probably let him go. You know, I've been obsessing about this story, too. And in fact, I've written to Eddie O'Brien and Rod Matthews in prison.
Who Eddie O'Brien is.
Eddie
for those
O'Brien
don't remember.
Murdered his next door neighbor. What was her name?
Janet Downing.
Janet Downing.
Yes. Best friend's mother.
Yeah, you know, stabbed her
98 times.
Something like that. Rod Matthews killed that little boy.
Took him into the
Sean
woods.
Sean Ouellette.
The baseball bat.
Back in the early 80s. So they were both 14 at the time. So actually, I've heard back from both of them. You know, they didn't want to get into it at this time because, you know, this is giving them a little bit of hope. But there are extenuating circumstances in both of those cases, unlike this one. This is a little like John Connolly, the FBI agent, because he didn't actually pull the trigger. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't have the gun in his hand when John Halloran was killed, which is why that case was overturned as well. So I think this is the perfect test case. And I agree. I think they should let him go.
And by the way, this is not just so we don't get email that we don't have to read. None of us are suggesting these were not heinous crimes.
No.
But even the Supreme Court of the United States acknowledged by majority decision that the young brain is not a fully formed brain,
like many
and there's
things,
some mitigating factors.
In the political world, the pendulum swings too far, because you may recall, Emily, that it used to be in Massachusetts, if you could murder somebody, you could murder two people or three people at 16 or 17, and you'd be out by 21. That was the law then, which was ridiculous. Yeah. So we swung too far in the other direction. It was the Eddie O'Brien case that really got things going, because he's a very hulking kid. I think he's 6'4", 6'5", and he did stab his neighbor so many times, and I think it was horrific, such a horrific murder. He's going to have a tough time, I think, Eddie O'Brien.
You know, the other one we've gone way too far in, and you'll probably both fight back on me on this, is that anybody convicted of a sexual offense, once they've served their time, 15 to 20 for rape, or 30 for rape with, you know, kidnapping charges, once they've served their time and eligible to be released, they're not. They're sent to Bridgewater, where they're detained for sexual evaluation. They will never get out. I communicate with some of these people. I don't think it's right. I mean, you know, was that the sentence? If that was the sentence, then that was the sentence.
But essentially, and your argument that continues, is essentially you're sentencing to life.
Yeah, you've sentenced them to life without giving them that sentence.
And I agree with you, I guess. But the flip side is that a lot of experts who are to be respected say that there's no cure for this kind of behavior.
A lot of those guys, they were under the, you know, influence of drugs and alcohol. You know, it was destitute situations.
How about pedophilia?
Well, that's another issue.
Okay. Let's go to something like, we've had a heavy first hour.
We're finally
going to move to something that I've been waiting for 24.
You know, you get a big kick out of this.
24 hours. This guy's name is Jacob Williamson, and he's never going to live it down. If you don't recognize the name, he's a spelling bee contestant, and he had a fairly embarrassing moment. Listen.
Kabara Goya.
Kabara Goya. I know it. I know it. I totally know it.
It's that voice.
Okay. Kabara Goya. C A B A R A G O Y A. Kabara Goya. What?
Kabara Goya is spelled K A B A R A G O Y A.
Poor kid.
That was almost as bad as Miss Junior South Carolina years ago. Such as the United States of
God.
You know,
how do you ever live that down?
I don't know. But I watched a lot of the spelling bee last night myself, and I was so impressed by these kids.
I know.
Spelling words and the really good ones, the ones when they get down to the two at the end, they would ask the judges, they were very clever. Please say it again.
The derivation.
Use it in a sentence. What language exactly? Yeah. So they know if it was from German or from Latin or from whatever language. I mean, they were so clever about it. And they were spelling.
I know.
impossible words.
Don't really deflect attention away from this. I want to talk about this for a second because I felt like I had done.
Really?
What?
I don't know why you.
I can't get away from this thing.
I can tell.
So what's
I'm not obsessing on this one.
Well, I am. What's the most embarrassing moment you've had publicly in your whole career, Emily Rooney?
Oh, my. I'd have to actually think.
What's
if
in
you
the
had
top
asked
bunch?
Me, I would have thought about this.
Well, how about you, Marjorie? Young, old, what's the most embarrassing public moment? And have you gotten over it? That's really the issue because I think the issue for this kid, since everybody in America and the world have seen this video, how do you ever live it down? I guess you go on the Tonight Show tonight
do you have
or something.
One?
Oh, yeah, I have quite a few. Oh, but why don't you start?
I have a few. I have many, actually. Well, the one that was really humiliating when I was a kid, like this kid, was I used to play the piano when I was a kid, and I accompanied this woman that played the cello. And we were up at this concert, and there were like three. It was worse for her, but still, there were like 300 or 400 people there. And I start to play the piece, and she doesn't play. And I started again, and she doesn't play. She's just sitting there with her bow poised over the cello. So I keep going, and I get up at the end of the first piece. I get up and stand on bow. She gets up and stands and bow. I'm saying, Michelle, what are you doing? What are you doing? She says, I don't know. I don't know. I'm nervous. We sit down again. We had two pieces. She never played
a note.
No,
what was
she
it, stage
just
fright?
Got stage fright.
I had that.
She forgot.
You mentioned stage fright is something that happened to me a couple times.
Tell us.
Yeah, well, once when I was at ABC News, I was leading the morning meeting, and I just froze, and I couldn't speak.
You literally couldn't speak?
No.
Was Peter Jennings there?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
And that
how did he
that?
React?
Oh, the whole thing, it was a disaster.
It was?
I don't think I lasted much longer after that. It was awful.
But how do you
I had to get up. I had to get up and walk away. I froze. I couldn't talk.
But see, the
and
whole
then
thing.
It was a panic attack is what it was.
Did you feel the blood rising
oh,
up
my,
your neck?
You
that's always
feel
fear, the blood.
Yeah. Panic.
Yeah.
It's like Dan Harris was talking about when he came
right.
in with a 10%
I told him,
happier,
I told
whatever
him
it is.
About that when he came because I said, you know, I had a panic attack when I was at ABC News, and I didn't want to say it on the air, but I just did here, but I told them about it.
Okay,
but
Jim,
see, the
your turn.
The
your
problem
turn.
With these, you know, first of all, you had a much more embarrassing moment, you've told us. Remember when you did the roast
oh
for former
God,
speaker Tom Finneran on live television?
Nobody laughed. It was so humiliating.
Well, because you were speaking truth. It was very funny.
I made jokes about their incestuousness and their salaries and so forth. Nobody thought that was funny.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
I thought it was funny. I was That's watching horrible. On Channel 38 on live live TV.
All right, Jim.
Well... a couple of years ago at NECN, I was pre-taping a segment, and I screwed up the read.
Yeah.
And so I said a word that one is not supposed to say, but it was on tape. But I didn't say it once, I said it three times.
Yeah.
But luckily, it was on tape. So we redid the segment, and I went home.
Yeah.
And my show was at 8 o'clock then. And at 8 o'clock, those are the days of beepers, so maybe it was 10 years ago, my beeper practically exploded off my belt. And I literally had like 20 beeps in 10. You know what the end of the story is. Yeah. The guy in Master Control forgot to tape over it. So it's me saying the F-bomb three times. But it's worse. It's one thing if you say it. It's nothing if you say it while you're looking at the camera.
Yeah.
So I am looking at the camera.
Wow.
I mean, by the way, I get like... my body as I'm even saying these words.
Yeah.
It was one of those things where you know how you tell the story, Marjorie, when you write a column you think isn't good enough and when you go to the newsroom
to
the next day you have to put your head down.
Yeah.
I didn't want to go to work ever again after that. It was one of those things.
You're lucky you didn't wind up like Anchorman.
Well, it was cable.
Yeah.
Does that make a difference?
Oh, I didn't violate. No, I don't think it violated
it
didn't.
Because it would have been broadcast because it happened to Jorge once live.
Kuroga.
Yeah, yeah.
Live?
Yeah, it was one of those... He was kind of off mic, but you heard it.
And what happened? Did he get in trouble?
Somebody picked it up. It was in the newspaper, and you know, it was one of the. I can't remember. I don't know what happened to him. Whether they suspended him for a day or something. I don't know what they did.
Well, speaking of being in the newspaper, the last embarrassing moment, and then we'll get to what you're really here for. Emily's list, of course. You remember the night that Jahar Tsarnaev was captured? Talk about humiliation.
Mm.
I am on set at NECN. Up until 7 o'clock, at the exact moment that they have located the younger Tsarnaev on Franklin Street, I think it was called, in Watertown. And we have the only reporter, Scott Yunt was the only reporter who was actually on Franklin Street at the moment. And about 2 minutes to 7, a young reporter starts motioning to me like, it's time for you to come off the set and I'll replace you. And I'm saying to myself, hello?
Yeah.
And if it had been a senior person, I wouldn't have done it. I
RD just, or something.
But it was a young kid who now actually has a huge career. I won't mention her name. And I want to make her feel bad. So I leave, and I'm really angry. So I go to my desk, and someone at the website, I sit near the website at NECN, said, so what do we know about this thing? And I said, we don't know. And then I used a curse word about this thing. Well, it turns out there were two problems. One, my mic was still on. And two, Brian Williams in NBC National News had picked up the NECN broadcast and were carrying it live. So they have this disembodied voice of this unknown anchor.
Saying we don't know S.
We don't know S about this
You're
thing.
You're off the reservation.
And went over national television. And by the way, I didn't get fired for that one either. So that's the end of my embarrassing moments. I didn't go to work the next day for that either. In any case, here's why you're here. Here's why we are here. This segment will continue for years. Here it is.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
Okay, I have tons of interest. Now, every week, I wasn't here last week. It was really hurting me that I couldn't be here for your last segment. I am supposed to ask, is this thematic, Emily Rooney?
It is, but one of these days I'm going to come up with one that isn't because it's just...
But today it is.
It is.
Fine, okay, take
so
it away.
So these are things that I noticed while driving last week because I went up to Lake George, and it's a long drive. It's 4 hours up, 4 hours back. So, Jim, I know this drives you crazy.
Go ahead.
But I can't help but noticing it, especially in the summer. People who drive on weekends and vacations... do not have Easy Pass. Why not?
Great one.
Why not?
Great one.
We've had this discussion with Rich Davey,
but,
by the way.
I heard it. But why don't they? It's the everyday people have them. Why? And by the way, the Easy Pass lanes are wide open on vacations and weekends. And these people are lined up. You know,
sometimes blocking those of us
yes.
who do have Easy Pass,
Many
we
times.
Can't get to the Easy Pass
because
line.
Because they think the government
understands. And that
is
the dumbest thing. Actually, I've had a conversation with Callie about this. And John Carroll, he has the same fetish. But they take a picture of your license every time you go through.
They do.
Plus, they have you on your cell phone.
Yeah. I mean, it's like...
They know where you are.
It doesn't matter.
You're
they know where
a
you
home
are.
Run
yeah.
so
okay.
far. What's
so the next,
next
one. In the 60 or so years I've been driving to Lake George, I pass these truck weigh stations. I have never
seen
once, not once, have I ever seen one open.
Amen. Ever.
Have you?
Ever.
No.
Have you
no.
ever? I mean, maybe in South Carolina, maybe in North Carolina.
I think maybe
never.
Once I saw
I've
one.
I've never, never seen one open. Never.
Yeah. Never.
Never.
I don't even understand
they
what
like
they're
nine
for.
They have them on Route 6 on the Cape, by the
what
way.
What are they for?
Never.
Well, you know, they had to put them on Route 6 on the Cape, even though no one ever uses them, because it's some federal highway.
Yeah.
That's why they
regulation.
Exist. Right.
Yeah.
You can't
I mean,
be over a certain weight.
Open.
I have no idea. Wow. These are good ones.
So people, here they are. Going someplace, and presumably they know where they're going. They have no idea the roads. They don't understand the connecting roads. So, coming off of I-87, which is the New York State Thruway, you can either go to New York, which is to the right, or you can go left to Boston. Everybody gets into the right-hand lane for miles and miles and miles. I get into my car, and it's not skirting when you know what you're doing. So you know how
I love the term skirting.
I don't like skirters. I'm going to what I know is an open lane. And sure enough, the Boston lane is wider. These people are packed 5 and 6 cars deep going to the right. And then they get all the way to the front and they realize, oh, I'm going to Boston. You know? And they don't realize that you can just... I don't understand that, why you wouldn't know your roads. All right. So here's the strangest thing we saw. And we passed the guy twice. It was an older BMW, like the 525 I-Series or something. And I noticed that right away because it was very boxy looking. He did not have a license plate on the back. And I thought, you know, that's unusual because a lot of people with hot cars don't like to put a license plate on the front because it ruins the look of the grill and all that.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I travel in that world a little bit.
Yes.
So my daughter goes, he's got to have it on the front. And I said, trust me, he's not going to have it on the front if he doesn't have it on the back. Sure enough, the guy had no plates on the car. And, you know, it's like cops up and down the highway. And he had this little thing taped to his windshield that looked like it might have been a registration. He didn't get stopped. People get stopped for the most unbelievable...
Are you outraged by that, Margaret?
I am outraged.
I just thought it was risky.
It's very risky. Yeah. Good thing you didn't have a light out or anything.
All right, here's a gross generalization, but I'm going with it. BMW drivers are the most aggressive.
They are?
Yeah. I don't know what it is. They come up right behind you. They toot at you. They blow past you. It's the BMW drivers.
What kind of car do you have?
I don't think she wants to tell us.
An Audi.
That's all?
Those are nice cars.
All right.
Why'd you pause there? We have a Bentley you don't want to tell us about?
No,
or what is
it? I have a little
an Audi.
Audi.
Okay,
all right, so here's another thing. If I pack a lunch for my drive, you know, it's a 4-hour drive, I want to eat it in the first 15 minutes.
Of course, who does it? But that's not something to be upset about.
By the way,
if you packed lunches for 10 people, you'd eat all 10 people's lunches
exactly.
right away.
Why is that?
I don't know. Because it's sitting there. It looks so good. I mean, if you pack lunch for work, you'll eat it at 9 o'clock. And then you have nothing to eat
That's
at lunch.
What we do every single
that's
day.
That's right. You've already eaten your breakfast and your lunch.
And here's the other thing. When you drive with me, there's no stopping. I mean, so you better be ready. I mean, you got to be prepared.
4 hours, no bathroom stop?
Absolutely
I'm
not.
I'm impressed.
No way I'm ever stopping. So I got the full tank of gas, the empty bladder, and that's the way
well,
it
goes. Well, you know what you do, and if worse comes to worse, you buy a big gulp and pour it out, and then you use what
yeah,
you have to use.
So that's you can't have any water
on your
ride, I guess.
All right, so this last one was really embarrassing.
What?
I don't even know if I can say it all.
Well,
oh, yes, say it.
Yeah.
All right.
So my daughter insisted that we listen. You know, I have Sirius. We've discussed Sirius yeah. before. Mm-hmm. That I listen to the Howard Stern Show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I could not believe what was going on the Howard Stern
How
Show
so?
When we... It was...
So raunchy.
You had naked women on?
It was even worse than that. It was a guy performing a sex act on himself with a commentary that you would not believe that was going with it. It was just... And then Howard, even though it was a tape, Howard interjecting, he's like, this is what people listen to. I
always, when Howard Stern used to be on regular radio.
Of course, my daughter
in
had
Boston.
Control of the radio, and I'm going, ah.
Yeah. When he was not talking about enormous breasts yeah. and sex acts, yeah. he was great. He would do great
the
interviews.
I
remember
my
when he
daughter
was getting
was
divorced,
that.
He would talk about the tribulations of his divorce and his kid and how everything was going with
he's
that.
He's very well prepared for the interviews.
He's really smart. There's something really endearing about him. And then all of a sudden, the switch goes on, and suddenly he's doing all this sex stuff. I don't know.
Yeah.
But apparently people like it because he's huge. Even
she was telling me, I can't remember who she was saying. He had just interviewed, a half an hour interview with some dignitary. Who was that? It was, I don't know, somebody big. And I said, well, does he use foul language? Is he gross with it? He said, absolutely not. He's totally appropriate.
Yeah.
So you didn't like that segment? Chelsea, we're going to have to cancel the next segment.
Okay.
Emily,
well,
I want you to know we said it yesterday in the meeting. Yeah. No two people alive, and I know this is a grand statement. No, I'm serious. We have as much respect for you as a human and you as a newswoman as anybody on the planet.
I appreciate that.
And so we're thrilled
we do.
You're not disappearing. And
I'll call you for my obit.
Okay.
Gee,
especially,
that's a horrible
I love
thought.
In your piece when you said you were afraid of John Silbert, the former president of Boston University, because I was too.
Yeah.
I saw him once at a funeral. I couldn't move. I was paralyzed the entire time. It was like two.
But that was part of his shtick.
Oh, totally. And Bill Bulger, too. He used to come on and quote Greek mythology.
Yeah, Bill Bulger.
And, you know,
he always wanted to intimidate you, didn't he?
Yeah.
Very upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
He's a little guy.
Yeah.
But he's managed to do it anyway.
Okay.
Bye.
Emily, not bye. Bye for today.
Bye for today. See you next week.
Emily, what are you doing tonight? Quickly, what are you doing?
We are going to do more on that Elliot Rodgers story.
Yeah.
And then I have a quick back and forth on the best part of the Aaron Hernandez arraignment the other day came at the very end when the attorney for Aaron Hernandez accused the Suffolk County DA's office of grandstanding for the press and trying the case in the press. And then the judge just got up.
He went
and,
off.
Just, you know.
Good.
Great.
Just good. Good.
Yeah, so we'll have a little
bit. We'll be watching.
Okay,
thanks,
Emily Rooney, thank you very much. As always, Emily joins us every Friday for Open Mic, and you can see her tonight on Beat the Press, and every night from now until for many months forward on Greater Boston at 7 o'clock on WGBH. Up next, Callie Crossley pays tribute to Maya Angelou. That's that and more coming up on Boston Public Radio.
WGBH sustainers keep this station going strong through convenient monthly installments that renew automatically. So right now, WGBH is giving credit where credit is due.
William Tyler.
Michaela Keating.
Regina Nazaro.
Vivian Trotta.
Nicole Griffin.
Stephen Ford.
Lee Carpenter.
Casey McGannon.
Evan Waters.
Thank you. To earn your own WGBH production credit, visit wgbh.org/sustainer.
Support for our programs comes from you and Gardner Mattress, celebrating their annual event at their Salem warehouse, located at 63 Flint Street, Salem, Mass., happening June 7th and 8th. Details online at gardnermattress.com. That's gardnermattress.com. And Newbury Court, a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. Newbury Court in Concord, Massachusetts. You can schedule a visit any day of the week by visiting newburycourt.org.
Welcome Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We talked to Callie Crossley this morning, and when we did, Eric Shinseki had not yet offered his resignation to the president, and the president had not yet accepted the resignation, needless to say. So again, this conversation happened before this morning's resignation, but we started with an interesting one about whether or not the general should leave.
So now an independent review says that the Department of Veterans Affairs officials have definitely falsified records, hiding the amount of time service members had to wait for medical appointments, saying this is not just in the hospital in Phoenix, but all across the country. The guy who runs the VA, Secretary Eric Shinseki, is still there. There's been a lot of speculation about whether or not he's going to resign. Should he get out of there, Callie Crossley?
Well, you know, I did a commentary about this last week, but I avoided saying whether he should resign or not because I really thought he shouldn't, and here's why. This is sort of part of the conversation we had about the DCF chief, and that is what happens after people really think something is resolved. The other thing about Shinseki, I know people are probably screaming at the radio now.
No, I think you're gonna, I think you make a great point.
He is totally dedicated to this. Now you can say someone can be dedicated but incompetent, and we have to address that. And that's true. So I'm sort of on the fence now, except that no one said what happens after. And that is my concern. The guy is a disabled veteran himself. I mean, I know, without knowing him, how deeply he feels about a veteran's not getting service they need. You know, he's a guy that needed service.
Yeah, but you know, Kelly, I heard a number of people in Congress say that too. What a wonderful person is, what great service. Yeah, I think he has two Purple Hearts. That doesn't mean you can manage a huge agency. So you can be a great person and an honored veteran and not be able to do it.
You know what?
Here's
a great point. People like you, Jim, were calling for the head of Olga Rochet for weeks. The head of DCF. We now have a woman, I would argue, is thoroughly and completely incompetent based on what I saw on your television show last night, and also knows absolutely nothing about child welfare. So I would argue our situation is worse. I don't think what's going on at the VA says anything about Shinseki's leadership. I think it says about a government where people hide facts. Mm. Now we know that people were cheating, falsifying records. That's the issue. Go after that culture that allows people to falsify records. There's no indication that he can't. And once again, we have a president at the end of his term. Once again, we may have somebody coming in there to fill a position that may be worse than what we've got.
Well, the latter may be true. But just as Deval Patrick said when he finally said it's time for Olga Rochet to go, when the public loses confidence in a leader, even if they unfairly lose confidence, and by your standards, it's unfair to lose confidence in Shinseki, even though I don't agree with you, somebody's got to pay a price here, and nobody except the guy who was going to retire anyway has left the administration.
Don't you think they have been identified now, and so now we should kick those people out who did it?
When you lose trust and the public has lost trust, when you have people like John McCain, who there's one thing the guy cares about are veterans. I mean, you can disagree with McCain on a whole host of things. When people like John McCain say the guy's got to go, and he said things like you said, Kelly, about what a wonderful record is, how patriotic he is, and these sort of things, it's clear to me whether you two, well, you're sort of on the fence, Kelly, you say keep him. It's clear this is Sebelius Part 2, Rochet Part 2. People, a lot of leaders, Deval Patrick, Barack Obama, there are tons of them, just can't cut the cord.
Okay, well,
Do either of you think Shinseki's going to...
Here's the question.
Wait, let me finish a sentence. Do either of you think Shinseki's going to survive? No.
Here's the question.
He may not.
Are you interested in trying to get things at the VA hospital fixed, or are you interested
What evidence do you have that he has any ability to fix it?
This is what I was about to say. Here is his record thus far, having, before this blew up, the man had reduced, paid attention to how homeless veterans are treated and improved that greatly. He reduced the regular wait times without the people hiding all this stuff by 45%. I mean, he knew what the issues were when he went in there and he went right at them, the hardest stuff. So he does have a record of having accomplished something that was very important to veterans. The fact that we have all these scuzzbags all over the place hiding this, you know, I don't know unless a whistleblower would tell him, you know, if it's uncovered that a whistleblower did tell him, all bets are off.
That's different. Okay. Yeah, you know. And the other great point you make, and this is so true, we get the scalp, we say, see you later, run the guy out of town, and then the media withdraws, the political pressure withdraws, and nothing changes. I would rather have the focus on what this guy's going to be able to do now that he has his information about people falsifying records and keep the pressure on than doing what you owe.
Okay, two final things
and
here.
Let me just tell you why the pressure is going to stay is staying up. The other thing that makes it sticky too and not so pure just about his leadership, and that is because it's totally political now. And
totally.
It's moving. Already I saw this morning an ad against Mike Begich, who's a senator, saying, oh, he didn't question Shinseki. He should go.
Yeah, but that is true. But there are Democrats, starting with you, Dole,
and then that
Veterans Committee guy from
Maine. 12 of them who are wanting him to resign.
Nine
of them are up for re-election. What the hell are they going to say? Except, yeah, get out, because they're trying to cover themselves.
One last thing before we leave this. Your term of art, I want to use your term scuzzbag. I believe that is a legal term. You know who the other scuzzbags are? I mentioned this on TV the other night. Did you watch the late night hearing that was on C-SPAN with the administrators from the VA, not Shinseki,
oh my
but others?
God.
Talk about posturing and people having to go who have no interest in fixing a problem, members of Congress, but rather pontificating and bloviating for the people back home.
They need to go. And I worry about a voucher system. Let me just put on that makes me nervous. I don't know why it makes me nervous, but it just makes me nervous. I appreciate the moving to private companies or to private hospitals. But by the way, here's a stat that I didn't know, that that there are only 9% of doctors available, I guess, have gone, you know.
It's a huge shortage.
Yes. But we have all of these vets coming back. So anyway.
But a great thing would be, before we move on from this, a great thing would be these stories where you hear people that are suicidal that can't get into the VA. If you're suicidal, go to the emergency room at the Brigham or wherever you live, and they will not let you out.
Yeah.
By the way, Jay Carney, the president's spokesman, just called and says he doesn't care what the three of us think. So I just want to be totally Can we move to something where I have a feeling there will be far more unity? You wrote a beautiful commentary, Kelly Crossley, on Maya Angelou, who obviously is no longer with us. Tell us about your history in her presence. It was really wonderful.
Well, it just made me think of my mom, who's been long gone, but my mom was the one who was very much a fan of her work and introduced me to her when I was a tween, as I say. And we went together. It was a mother-daughter trip, so it's especially powerful in my memory, to a local college to watch her or to see her speak. And I didn't know what she was going to do. And it was just an amazing performance. She spoke, she sang, she danced, she talked. She engaged the audience before we were talking about interactiveness. I mean, I just sat there, just, I use the word dazzled in my commentary because I was completely dazzled. 3 hours, nobody moved, nobody thought it was 3 hours. That's how powerful it was. So, that was my first introduction. After that, she was a part of my life. I would, when I got older and lived here in college, I would run to Harvard Square the minute that book, with the next installment of one of her pieces of autobiography would come out. There are 6 parts.
You said, and, like, kids run at midnight for Harry Potter books.
They had nothing on me. You know? It was great.
And you know what else I had forgotten until this week when I was reading up on her because she passed away? The story she told about when she was 3 years old, near-do-well parents she had. She's 3 years old, her brother's 4 years old. Her father puts her on a train in California, descends her to the two of them, toddlers, cross the country alone to Arkansas with their little tickets pinned inside them. And she lived with this great grandmother, who I guess was a very strong woman in her life. Then the father comes back 4 years later, takes her back and sends her back to the near-do-well mother, where she has a horrific, abusive time with her mother's boyfriends and so forth. I mean, this woman came from the worst of circumstances and persevered.
I don't know how she did it, including that period of time in her life after she was raped, and she just stopped speaking because she thought she had brought it on herself. And this is well before, you know, we had all of the experts say, the victims blaming themselves. So the way that she has written about it, though, I can't tell you. Her imagery is so rich, it's tasty. You just sit there. I remember a description she had of a boyfriend that when she realized the moment she needed to get rid of him, she looked at him, and I can't do it justice, so look it up. It's one of the autobiographies. She looked across and saw him on the couch and thought he looked like a turtle and his little head was shrinking back on his neck. And I just thought this. And she thought at that moment, he's got to go. This is not the guy for me.
You know what else I thought was really significant about her is that here she is, black woman growing up in the Jim Crow South, told her story, warts and all, which was very unusual,
yes,
about being a madam, basically, for lesbian prostitutes,
yes,
and stuff, not at all painting herself, you know, covering up those difficult chapters in her life. That was almost revolutionary.
It's all, I mean, she was, that's the part that I think just endeared her to everybody, because she knew that everybody had something, as Robin Roberts' mother would say. So she would bring all of that out, and I think that's what brought all of her fans to her, so that people who really revered her and respected her and loved her work come from all quarters.
Yeah.
All
well,
quarters.
She crossed, I mean, who else? She crossed racial lines at
yeah,
a time
absolutely.
When there were not
global
that many
people.
Yeah. I mean, white women were like flocking to her in a way that was new. I
absolutely.
Mean, who else? Who else? Maybe Zora Neale Hurston? I don't know.
No. And Zora Neale Hurston had an impact from a literary standpoint, but I think from both a
pop.
Literary and a pop and then a personal.
Yeah.
You felt a resonance, a personal resonance. Everybody felt her stories were universal to them. You know what I thought about too, which has
what?
Nothing to do with anything, that when she died, this was really Oprah's mother, you know.
Great
and I
point.
And since I was writing about my mother and how she brought me to her, I just felt like that pain you feel when you lose your mother. And I don't know Oprah. I did not know Maya personally, but I just felt that, you know.
Yeah. You wrote a beautiful piece about it, and she was great. A woman of great faith, too.
Yes, absolutely.
Her last tweet.
Last tweet. If you listen in the quiet solitude, you can hear God.
I know. It's pretty good.
All now, right, who's going to embarrass themselves by moving on to the next topic after this? Okay,
don't you do it, Jim.
I'll belly up to the bar.
We
okay.
can go highbrow and lowbrow.
Well, let's go. This is best.
That's low.
Well, it's low, but I actually love this story, to tell you the truth. This, if you go on Twitter and you go to Hidden Cash, mm-hmm. you'll find this interesting anonymous character who's doing something that I have to say I love. And maybe I like it more than I should, but I love these kinds of things. Tell us about this anonymous, I guess he's a West Coaster, or she's a West Coaster. I don't know whether it's a man or woman. The person on the West Coast who is behind this Hidden Cash.
I don't know
thing.
Why I think it's a man, too, but you know, I think it's a man. And he says he made a lot of money in real estate, and he wanted to do something different. He's giving away money in other, more significant ways, but he thought, everyday people, let's try something different. So he's putting pockets of money, I guess around $100. The first guy got $120. And he leaves clues on Twitter so you can follow them and get them. The video of the guy who got it off the fire hydrant, you know, the other day was very funny. And apparently he did a second drop and a woman got it this time. And she's just very excited about it. He just said, you know, pay it forward. Enjoy it for the moment. It wasn't money you were expecting. So it's kind of interesting. Now, it's funny. I looked at some of the comments. Some people are very resentful of it and said, you know, if he has money to give, he should do something more significant with it. And he's just trying to relieve his guilt about something. I don't know.
Oh,
from his tweets, he just seems to think, I got money. I want to spread it around. And I enjoy seeing people engage with me on Twitter. So I guess he can do that.
Did you mention what one of the clues was? They're fun. I mean, one of the clues that caused this guy to go find $100 is stand on top of the caterpillar that's close to the water. And the caterpillar was not a caterpillar like a bug. It was the caterpillar like the vehicle. Exactly. And he found it. And the guy says, in terms of paying it forward, he said, I hadn't budgeted for the $100. He went and had the $100. Huge fun. He's taking his coworkers out to lunch.
Which is
so
nice.
It's not quite Maya Angelou level, but
no.
It is a wonderful kind
I
of
hope he doesn't reveal himself, by the way, if I may say.
Well, you know, the good news is for those of us who are upset because he's only operating on the West Coast, like LA and San Jose, if you read on in the stories, he actually hopes next month to come to New York City.
Right.
So if you tweet Hidden Cash, maybe he'll even come to
New
England, and we're hoping, yeah.
Well, let's move on to somebody else who isn't exactly Maya Angelou either. That would be Buddy Cianci.
This is one of your under the radar
things. One of my stories for under the radar this Sunday.
The former mayor of Providence, who apparently wants to become the mayor of Providence again. I don't know if you know, Callie, that Jim and Buddy Cianci almost had a television co-host.
I can't believe you don't remember this.
He was almost a co-host with Buddy Cianci.
My former boss, Charlie Kravitz, had almost cut a deal where Buddy Cianci and I, this is years ago, were going to co-host the thing on NECN. Didn't come to pass. And this is, I said, he is? He's really, I'm just really excited. I mean, for those who don't know, this is a guy who served 20 years, two stints as mayor, went to jail twice, once for corruption, the other time I'll tell you about in a second. And I said to Charlie Kravitz, he's really willing to do this. He says, yeah, well, there's two caveats. There are two things you may not mention on the show. Now, I'll ask you, Kelly, what were the two things I was told, if it had happened, that I may never say to him? What
the
are
two
they?
Times he went to jail?
No, I could mention the corruption thing was fine.
Okay.
One, I couldn't mention the toupee. And two, and we were all shocked when we saw photos of him in jail without the toupee. And two, I could not mention the cigarette or log he used to burn the hand of the alleged lover of his estranged wife, which is one of the reasons he went to jail once. So other than that, everything was in the mix.
What was going to be the name of the show? The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly?
Well, that's a very good line. No, Breaking Bad was actually the name of the show. Hey, but the reality is they say, because it's potentially a five-way primary, 73 years old, this is not, it's not impossible. The guy's mayor for a third time.
Well, you know, he's run in a crowded field before and come with a razor-thin victory, but he's won. That's what Philip Isle of the Providence Phoenix was pointing out this morning. There are, his name has a lot of resonance, and so if you have a five-way race and one guy with big name recognition, even though Philip says, you know, I was seven and I saw the guy around, and so he doesn't have a huge resonance for me. The older folks know who he is. So they vote, however. So it's quite possible that he could do it. In the meantime, he gets to tease this out as long as he wants. Some people say a la Hillary Clinton, because the filing deadline is June the 25th. So he's got a good more month, and he's on the air every day on
his
own.
Did you live in
Providence
while
he was... I lived
in Providence
while he was the mayor.
He, I mean, even though he's... I mean, the Providence Journal hates him, but the people love him, right?
People loved him. Well, my husband at the time worked for the Providence Journal, so we were always down in the Providence Journal bar telling Buddy Cianci stories, but even the reporters had a grudging respect for him, because he was a fun guy to be mayor. You never knew what he was going to say next. But also, he during his term, before he went away on corruption charges, he revitalized the whole city.
Yes,
Providence
that's right.
is a spectacular place to live now. It used to be kind of one of those kind of dumpy cities, you know. Now it's beautiful. It's got that fire thing
water
going
fire,
on.
Yeah.
Yes.
People say that if he comes back, then it just reminds people of the corruption and, you know, that he made Providence synonymous with that as
right.
well.
But people have those love-hate relationships with rogues. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. Believe me, I know. My relatives in Louisiana, Edwin Edwards, they would just keep reelecting him. I said to my cousin, why? Just tell me why. He said, Callie, we like our crooks honest.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, do you have a story about some broccoli situation or something?
Oh, no, actually, I'm glad you brought that up. Before we say farewell, yesterday you sent me on a mission.
Yes.
We were talking and you said, we were discussing, we all love Brussels sprouts, by the way, which is a rarity.
Yeah.
And kale is obviously the vegetable of whatever, of the moment. And you mentioned to me that there was a new hybrid called Brussels kale. You showed me the article. Mm-hmm. I love both things. So Callie knows that I go to Whole Foods twice a day. She sent me on a mission. She said, go find Brussels kale. Now, the bad news is it is not yet either in Cambridge or Newton. The good news is they expect it.
Oh.
The better news is I learned of another hybrid you may not know about. Do you know that there is a broccoli cauliflower a hybrid that I bought and steamed last night, and it is fabulous.
I would love that. What's it called?
It is fabulous.
Brockcock?
Excuse me, Brockcock? Thank you, Kelly Crossley. Okay, let's end it right there. I have no idea. They just handed it to me. I paid for it. I cooked it.
Pale green, correct?
Yeah, it is.
Yes, I've tried that before.
You know what? I think I've seen that.
Yes, you've seen that.
Yeah,
you've seen that.
Yeah. But it tastes like more like cauliflower than broccoli?
It tasted, actually it did. I hadn't thought about it, but it did. But it was fabulous. I'll bring you some. And as soon as I find Brussels kale, you'll be the first to know.
Yay!
Okay. Callie, thanks.
Callie Crossley, thank you for joining us as always. And Callie Crossley is the host of Under the Radar. You can catch her Sunday nights at 6 o'clock right here on 89.7 WGBH. And I just want to say we taped Callie earlier today before Secretary Shinseki, from the VA resigned. Okay, up next, it's time for our Friday news quiz. Get ready to bug out on the women behind six foods who eat insects. They want you to eat insects too. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Misogyny is not necessarily macho.
We're allowed to have girls in our dorm room?
Not girls, Gil. Women. We're college men now.
He's in college great.
It's going to be a great year.
A champion of nerd culture discovers how getting the girl can be a dangerous idea after the shooting in Santa Barbara. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Lesley University, where creativity empowers educators, artists, and counselors to turn their passions into their futures. Lesley University, what will you make happen? More information available at lesley.edu. And New England Wildflower Society's Garden in the Woods in Framingham, your source for native plants for sustainable gardens. More information available at newenglandwild.org/store.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. It's time for our Friday news quiz. Omnivores, this one is for you. And trigger alert for all insects within listening range. You may not like what you're about to hear. Here with us in Studio 3 are Rose Wang and Laura DeSoro. They're part of the startup Six Foods, it's called, which is dedicated to promoting eating insects. It's healthy, it's sustainable, and they say it is tasty too. Laura and Rose, it's good to meet you both. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so please explain what you're doing with these insects and why we should want to eat them.
Go ahead, Laura, take it away.
So there's a few reasons you might want to eat insects. First of all, there's health. So we work with crickets, which are up to 70% protein when dried, which is really impressive. There's also sustainability. So it takes 2,000 gallons of water to produce a pound of beef, but to produce a pound of crickets, it only takes about 1 gallon of water.
Is that so? Really?
Yeah.
Okay. And by the way, Six Foods is because what? There's six legs on
Six legs are better than four.
Okay. So it's hard to get over the hurdle, even if they're dried crickets, because they crunch, don't they, when you swallow them?
That's a really good question. What we've done is we actually have done so many experiments to see what people will eat. And what we realized, so once we actually made these mealworm tacos that we brought to the Harvard Innovation Lab for a pitch competition, and basically we grounded up the mealworms so they look like ground beef, and you couldn't tell that they were crickets. Mealworms. And Laura and I put it in the fridge, and we went to wait for our pitch, and we were the last to go. So we come back 2 hours later, and we made 50 of these, and only 5 were left because people thought they were so good, but not knowing that they were eating mealworms. And what was really interesting about this, though, is when we took it to the judges and told them, oh, here are mealworm tacos, even though they saw that other people had eaten them, they were still a little bit taken aback because they could see the insect. And so what we learned from this is the taste is there. We know that the nutrition is tremendously great for people, but how can we make sure that people aren't scared and there's no crunch? And right. So what we've done is we use cricket flour, which is 100% of the cricket ground up into a fine flour. It looks like brown sugar, and it has a slightly nutty taste to it that goes really well with baked goods, snack foods. And so our first product that we're bringing to market is our chirp chips, and they're basically bean-based chips with cricket flour, and they're so healthy for you. They taste like normal tortilla chips, but they also have 3 times the protein and half the fat of your normal potato chip.
And first of all, we do not forgive you for not bringing some, but we'll get by that. I was waiting all day to try these. Can we get them anywhere now, Laura, or they're not yet? Where? Or?
So you can pre-order them on our website at sixfoods.com.
And when is this? Is it SIX or is it the number?
SIX.
When are they going to be available? If we pre-order them, how long do we have to wait till we get a chirp chip?
We want to have them on store shelves this September, so in the fall.
Now, did you have your first experience? I mean, Marjorie and I were both asking. We actually read. But Laura started me. What's the first insect you ate? Where and why?
Oh, okay. So I was an African studies major in college, and I was studying abroad in Tanzania. And they were fried caterpillars from a street vendor on the side of the road. And I was like, when else am I going to get to try a fried caterpillar? So I did it. I took it. It was like wiggly looking and put it in my mouth. And I was super surprised because it tasted a bit like lobster. And it makes sense because insects and crustaceans are closely related. Yep. And so I was super surprised how delicious it was. And I've been off and on vegetarian my whole life. So it made me think about why I was vegetarian and made me think that insects could be this more sustainable protein source that I'd been looking for my whole life.
And by the way, I'm so glad you mentioned lobsters. And one of the stories we read, Rose, is lobsters, I mean, they're bottom feeders. They're all people felt about them, 50 or 75 or 100 years ago, like Marjorie feels about insects
today,
right?
I must admit, yeah.
I mean, isn't that a fair parallel?
Absolutely. And we like to draw upon that parallel to show that culture can change.
Yeah.
In the past, people used to feed lobster to prisoners because nobody wanted to eat them. And so what we're seeing is that it's more about psychology, right? If we can change people's minds about the value of these insects and what they can do for us nutritionally and what they can do for the world in terms of sustainability, then I think they're value is much higher.
And most of the world is already into them, right?
Yeah.
We're the outliers.
So this is the marketing challenge. How do you do that? I mean, how are you going to get these chips to fly off the shelves, Rose?
Love the bug puns.
Yeah, it was. She didn't even mean it. That's how beautiful it is.
That's right. How do you do it, though? Because I remember when I was a kid eating a chocolate-covered ant, and that was a novelty. We dared each other, and so we did it. But I don't think I go out and buy any chocolate-covered ants. I'm not sure I go out and buy chips made of crickets.
Right. And I think that's the part where, first of all, we decided to use products that you can't see the crickets in. And I think that's a big point in helping people get over the ick factor. The second thing is that the chips have to stand alone as a product. Regardless of cricket flour or not, they have to taste good on their own as a food product.
Okay.
And our chips taste great. So we actually did a taste testing on the streets of Cambridge. And you can see it on our Kickstarter site that we actually just finished. But people were... they loved the chips. And so that was another sign for us that, you know, these products can stand alone on just based on taste. And then lastly, it's based on like the value propositions that people care about when it comes to food. So it could be nutrition. And so if you care about nutrition, you're getting a huge bang for your buck by buying our chips because you're getting the protein that you might not be able to get in your normal chip. And it's low fat. And so you're getting the nutrition you need and you can't really find that anywhere else.
Rose, you ever heard the expression, you could talk a dog off a meat truck? Let me tell you, what a saleswoman.
That was pretty good.
Before
we
start the quiz, we're going to start it in 30 seconds. Rose, we heard where Laura's first insect eating experience was. Where was yours?
Mine was in China. And
I've eaten insects in China. What'd you eat?
I ate a scorpion and I ate it.
I haven't eaten a scorpion.
Scorpion. Oh.
And how was that prepared?
It was fried. It was like a scorpion kebab. There were three on a stick.
Look at Marjorie. This is so great. Okay, let's start this thing. We're with Rose Wang, Laura DeSoro. They are the founders and the two women behind Six Foods, which is promoting eating insects for all the reasons you heard. Who do you want to ask the first question?
Okay, you ready, Laura? I'll start with you. You ready?
All right.
Okay, what's the significance of these two words? Oh, my goodness.
Feuilleton.
Stichomythia.
Okay.
Okay. Do you happen to know?
Someone made up that word.
I'm clueless. I've been doing a startup since October.
No excuse.
It's
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Can we hear the two words one more time, please?
Yeah.
Feuilleton.
Stichomythia.
Do anything for you?
Nah, I don't know. You know,
do you have
Rose?
Any idea, Rose?
You sound like diseases.
Well, they may be.
I don't know. I have no idea what they mean or how you spell them, but I do know they were two words that resulted in a tie in last night's National Spelling Bee final. You want to try spelling them? Either of you guys want to spell them? You went to Harvard, didn't you? Aren't you both Harvard grads?
Uh-oh.
Can you use it in a sentence, please?
No. Okay, next question.
I have no idea what it means.
Here we go.
How you spell it.
Okay, Rose, here's your first question. Here's Stephen Colbert. He's our favorite at the quiz, weighing in on a national epidemic back in 2009.
I'm sorry, but our bodies are the only growth industry America has left. China may have 1.4 billion people, but I doubt they'd outweigh the combined residents of Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Being overweight is as American as eating a whole apple pie. And we're the majority, folks. 67% of the population is either overweight or obese. The scales are literally tipped in our favor.
Okay, Rose Wang, here's your question. Obesity or being overweight, obviously, you know, is a global epidemic. According to a new study, roughly what percentage of the global population is now overweight or obese? If you're close, we'll give it to you. What's the answer?
Ooh.
Obviously not eating insects. What's the answer?
Well, I'm going to say, so let's say the U.S. population is about 300 million.
Yeah.
And the global population is about
six to seven billion.
Yeah.
Okay, what percentage?
Oh my gosh.
Roughly.
Five.
That would be wrong. What is the answer? You have a guess, Laura? You can steal this baby.
For the people who are overweight, what percentage?
Overweight or obese around the world,
what
percentage roughly?
Let's see. I'm going to go with a lot more than that. I'm going to go with like 50%.
That would also be wrong. It's a third,
which
is roughly the percentage in the United States. So
if you averaged our percentages, it would
be
exactly right.
That's a very good point. It's partners, but it doesn't work that way in the quiz.
Oh, man.
Okay, round
here we
two.
Go. Here's Conan O'Brien's take on some news coming out of Washington, D.C.
The White House website has a new feature where you can go on a
So far, the most popular destinations are the Lincoln bedroom, the Bill Clinton bedroom, and the Hillary Clinton bedroom.
Okay, so what online perk is WhiteHouse.gov now offering?
Perhaps stays at the White House?
Is that good enough, judges? No, it is not, apparently.
No,
the judges say
they're tough.
How about
they're
a rose?
Tough.
You going to take this one?
A tours of the bedrooms?
How about that, judges? We're going to take it. Virtual tours of the White House. So we gave you the points.
Okay.
Now, Rose, here's your chance to plunge into a huge 2-point lead. Right? What royal family is Craig Ferguson talking about in this clip?
A great day for America's first family. I'd like to say congratulations to you both on your wedding. Unless this is a rerun, of course, in which case my condolences on your divorce. Anyway, they got married in Florence. Now, their name Florence holds special meaning for because it's the name that Bruce Jenner goes by. No.
That's not nice. Okay, what royal family is Ferguson talking about there, Rose Wang?
Are we talking about
Kimye? The Kimyes, yes, exactly. Kim Kardashian and
very
Kanye
good.
West. They did get married in Florence, Italy. So you now have 2 points. Hey, before we go to the next round, Laura, some vegetarians don't eat meat for health reasons.
Right.
Some vegetarians don't eat meat for moral reasons.
Right.
In the latter group, is the pitch being made to them that you don't have to worry about eating a scorpion or eating an ant or a mealworm? Is that part of the pitch?
It's definitely more humane, as in there's not factory farming the same way. If you think about how insects live, think like of a bee's nest or like an anthill. Insects are used to living in close quarters. So they can be raised humanely and they can also be put down humanely. So you can just freeze them. That's how they're killed. And they're cold-blooded, so they just go to sleep and then don't wake up from it. So a lot of vegetarians would do that.
And Rose, Laura talked a few minutes ago about the environmental impact, the amount of water needed to cultivate, I don't know if that's the right verb, a pound of beef as opposed to a pound of some insect. How about the cost? What is the cost of a meal that would be mealworm tacos as opposed to beef tacos? I mean, how do they compare?
Right. So if we're talking at scale, they would be a lot less expensive because of the efficiency of conversion of feed to food. So you'd use a lot less feed to get the same amount of food, and you'd use a lot less water. And space-wise, you don't need that much space, right? You can rent urban warehouses to raise these insects. However, it's not being produced at scale for human consumption right now, which is why it's more expensive. And so we're looking at probably close to about, $20 a pound for a cricket, which is quite expensive. But also the meat market or the meat industry is very much subsidized by the government.
Right, it is.
And so it's not a fair comparison.
So how'd you guys get together and decide we're gonna make insect food? I mean, did you meet at a fraternity party one night or
Rose and I were college roommates.
Oh,
so
yeah. You're at Harvard.
Right, exactly. So after I ate the caterpillar in Tanzania, I sent Rose an article because when you've got crazy ideas, what do? You send it to your college roommate.
Exactly.
And Laura's from Seattle, so she's a little bit more alternative than I am. And when she sent me the article, she was like, this is crazy, I know, but what do you think? And had I not been in China literally the week before she sent me that article, I think I would have thought she was crazy. But because I tasted the insect and I got over the hump, it literally is just a hump. I think once you start eating it and you realize it's not scary, then it totally made sense to me. And then I started reading these articles about all the sustainability and all the health benefits. Yeah. And the question became, why aren't we eating insects?
You know, Marjorie, chirp chips do not have cricket heads in them. They have cricket.
Well, the fact that they're ground up like that and you can't really see them, they look like brown sugar. I mean, maybe I could. If I didn't know, it's like the people with the refrigerator. If I didn't know what it was, I'd probably eat half the thing. But knowing what it was, it's sort of tough to get down.
Next question for Laura from you.
Yeah. Are we on the.
Not the bonus round yet. Go.
Okay. We're on the. Who is this speaking here? I think. Yes. Who is this speaking here?
I was trained as a spy in sort of the traditional sense of the word, in that I lived and worked undercover, overseas, pretending to work in a job that I'm not, and even being assigned a name that was not mine.
Who is it?
I do not know.
Do you know who it is?
Take a guess.
What a Rose.
Rose,
what are you
is that you? Your voice sounds different.
How about that? We're going to give you a hint. He has been hugely in the news lately, and that statement was made from a foreign country which he currently cannot leave. Laura, does that help you out at all? Don't look at Rose.
I don't know.
Okay, Rose, you can steal it. Who is it? Exactly. Okay, that was Edward Snowden. Final question before the bonus round, very quickly.
Oh, this Snowden, one, yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, whatever. This one is going to be easy for you, but maybe tougher for folks playing along at home. Who is this dispensing worldly advice, and where was he dispensing it? Go ahead.
So tonight, have one last scorpion bowl at the Kong. On second thought, don't. And tomorrow, get back to work making our country and our world freer forever, freer for everyone.
Who was it and where was he saying it?
This is Bloomberg at the Harvard commencement.
That is exactly correct. Give her the points. Okay, it's 3-0. We're starting the bonus round. And since your goal, the two of you, is to encourage people to eat insects, we're asking you about someone who needs no encouragement. That, of course, is the anteater. Why don't you start, Marjorie, with Rose?
Okay, I'll start with Rose. You ready, Rose?
Okay.
Okay. This is multiple choice. Who's Peter the Anteater? A, the mascot for the University of California at Irvine. B, the drummer for the Knoxville-based band Turbo Biscuit. Or C, the write-in candidate for mayor in Tempe, Arizona. Who's Peter the Anteater?
Wow, I hope he's not eating any of them. I would say, Peter the Anteater. B.
That would be wrong. You can steal it. A or C, mascot or write-in candidate for mayor, Laura. Who is it? Which is
I'm going to go with A. Mascot.
That is correct. Give her the points.
Correct. Very good.
What's
the
score? 3-1, judges? You can tie this up. This one's worth 2 points. What a coincidence. Now, here it is. Laura, the anteater's stomach functions like A, a vacuum, B, a cement mixer, or C, the veggetti, one of my favorite kitchen tools. Go ahead. Which of the three? Is it vacuum, cement mixer, or veggetti?
I'm going to go with cement mixer.
That is correct. The anteater's stomach has hardened folds and uses strong contractions to grind insects, and it's some digestive process that's assisted by small amounts of ingested sand and dirt. You knew that, Marjorie, didn't you? Exactly.
Christ, yeah. Okay. You ready, Rose?
Yes.
The anteater is a fully functional mammal, even though it does not have A, teeth, B, knuckles, or C, eyelids.
If you get this right, you win. If you get it wrong, it goes to Laura, and she could win. Go ahead, Rose.
A, teeth.
Correct.
That is correct.
That is correct.
And you the winner. Teeth. Now, are anteaters on the menu at Six Insects, or are they not?
We don't eat them, but they would be like our friends.
Oh, of course they would. Now, tell us very quickly, only a minute left, what are the bugs that are, we understand that crickets are in chirp chips. What are the bugs that are on the horizon from Six Foods? Laura, what do you got there?
Well, my favorite bug is called the waxworm. We call them honey bugs. They are pests in nature, live in bees' nests, eat the honey and wax, and taste like bacon.
Oh, they taste like bacon.
I've never had anyone who doesn't like them.
Really? So are your friends, when you make these confections for your friends, are they just scarfing them right up?
Now, there's some of our friends we've fed so many times that they don't even blink, and they like the foods we eat. So I don't know if, say, they're scarfing them up, but they absolutely love it. We work with a chef here in Boston called Jeff Lucas. He's the chef de cuisine at Sofra Bakery here in Cambridge.
Oh, Sofra's great.
Oh, yeah.
North Cambridge. And does he make all this stuff? Is that the deal?
So he helps us make some of our fresh food dishes that we talk about, like with the waxworms and the mealworms. So the tacos, he makes a really great mealworm arancini. These are things that he helps create with us, and it's been such a hit.
Yeah, we had a launch party for our Kickstarter, and we had 150 people eating insect food all in one place, and that was
Marjorie
pretty cool.
Marjorie wasn't there, obviously.
Give us the website one more time.
Sixfoods.com.
Sixfoods.com.
Good luck to you, too.
Congratulations to you guys. I hope you're the next,
Steve Jobs.
Anteater millionaires or whatever. Rose Wang and Laura DeSaro are behind the startup Six Foods. To learn more about them again, it is sixfoods.com. Thanks for coming in. And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in Monday for our conversation with former CI operative Valerie Plame. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, Devin Karambolis, and Alan Mavis. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Have a great weekend. Thanks for tuning in. Please tune in again on Monday.